Well, actually, it's been quite a long time since I've taught in the Education Hour. In fact, I don't think I've taught at all this year in 2014. Others have been doing that, but it is good to be back in this position again teaching. You're here this morning to learn what a Baptist is. What's interesting to me is, even though, as I look across the room, most of you probably have a very long Baptist, I suspect that few of you have a real understanding of what it means to be a Baptist. What differentiates us from others who believe the Bible as well? Names are really important. This week, one of the individuals that I read, I've introduced him to you by way of a couple of his books, Tom Rainer. Tom Rainer, in one of his blog posts this week, wrote an article entitled Seven Trends in Church Names. So the name of our church, First Calvary Baptist Church, seven trends in first name. Let me give these to you and then give you a little bit more. One, newer churches are consistently using descriptors in their names other than denominational affiliation. Some are focusing on their location. Others are at least implying a distinctive doctrinal leaning. Others are using more trendy and less common terms. So using descriptors more than denominational affiliation. So instead of saying such and such Lutheran church, such and such Baptist church, such and such Presbyterian church, they change the name or pick a name that doesn't have that particular idea in it. Number two, denominational names, though, are still dominant among church names. Denominational names dominate. And Baptist is the major denominational name. So if you were just at random to think, what's the name of that church? The most likely scenario would be that it had the name Baptist in it. That's the most common denominational name. Three, the most common church name is, and we want to take a stab at that? No, listen to what I just said. And First Baptist, that's right. The most common name is First Baptist. Over 5,000 churches have this name. And then, of course, there are some that aren't satisfied with just having First in the name. You have to have a second word, like Calvary, in your name as well and make it First Calvary Baptist Church. Many words, number four, are becoming common in newer church names. Brian, like? I know, but I just teed up for you. Give the same answer. Give the same answer. Brian said grace. Many words are becoming more common in newer church names. Community, fellowship, assembly, center, chapel, life, faith, Bible, grace, new. Number five, outsiders are often confused about church names. Not just that it has a denomination, but for example, the second most frequent response in a survey that Rainer did about the preferred denominational names was the word community or the community denomination, when in fact there is no such thing as the community denominations. The point is there's confusion about it, even in names. Number six, the internet has led to shorter church names because who wants to type in the URL of a very, 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 very long name? Number seven, church names may be important, but they are not the most important factor in people choosing a church home. Those factors are relationships, personal invitations, good preaching, friendly people, and a number of other reasons that go along with that. That's interesting, but let me tell you what's more interesting. The comments that many people wrote on the blog. You might enjoy these. One writer put this, in Arkansas, there is a church named First Baptist Church of Hicks. Or this one. I used to drive by one nearly every day in Waco called Pentecostal Cathedral of Faith Church of God in Christ. There you go. That's a lot of words. How about this one? Once while traveling in rural South Carolina, we saw a church named Harmony Church. About 300 yards, this is a guy who wrote this, about 300 yards down the road was another church named The Real Harmony Church. Or this one. My current church is Second Baptist Church, which made more sense in 1922 when there was another Baptist church in town. I've had a number of people ask me about Fourth Baptist over in Plymouth, and where are the other three? That's, of course, somewhat humorous. This one person wrote, "Where can I find the answer to, quote, why are so many churches first when Jesus specifically said the first shall be last?" That's a good question. Somebody responded, "I've always wanted to plant a church and call it the Last Baptist Church of whatever, and then put Matthew 20:16 on the sign." This pastor wrote, "I pastor a church and recently had a man publicly threaten he would leave our church if I kept preaching, teaching on the importance of being a disciple of Jesus Christ. Pray for pastors." Here's a guy. The poor guy is preaching on being a disciple of Jesus Christ, and some brother in the congregation calls him out for preaching on being a disciple of Christ. He said, "So I've decided, just so there's no confusion, the name of our next church plant will have God's purpose for his church plainly stated in its name. Quote, the Church of Disciples of Christ." All right, well, good. Here's this guy. He wrote in. I mean, these are actual people. You can go to the website and see it yourself. "My favorite name is Flippin' Church of God. It's in a real town called Flippin'." Another guy wrote in, "My favorite name I ever saw was just north of Nashville. The church was named Little Hope Baptist Church." Little Hope, Tennessee. "Two of my favorites come from a road trip through rural South Carolina." I don't know what it is with South Carolina. "Rapture Ready Baptist Church" and "Weeping Mary Baptist Church." "There's a wide spot of the road on Highway 24 in Northwest Alabama called Burnout. And you guessed it, there is a Burnout Missionary Baptist Church. There's a church in Slaughter, Louisiana called the Slaughter Worship Center. I have passed by this several times while in Orlando." Has anybody, when you travel to Orlando, seen this one? "The Basilica of the National Shrine of Mary, Queen of the Universe." Has anybody ever seen that? Have you seen it? I'm told it is monstrous huge, that particular place. Our church name here in North Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, beautiful place, is called Barefoot Church. Named for the area it was originally started, called Barefoot Landing. I received many texts actually asking, "What is Barefoot Church?" from those thinking, since we are located only blocks from the ocean, everyone comes barefoot. Due to the relaxed environment, some do, but that was not the intention. I had a friend who once pastored Plainview Baptist because 50 years prior, they split from a church about a quarter mile up the road and said they were going to build their new church in plain view of the other one. "My favorite real church name is just south of Nashville." So we had one north of Nashville. Now this one's just south of Nashville. "It is the Progressive Primitive Baptist Church." That's funny. "My favorite is the Halfway Baptist Church at Halfway, Missouri." Another person, "I saw a church that started in a funeral home called," you want to take a guess? "Resurrection." That's right, Resurrection Baptist Church. "There's a traditional looking church in rural Alabama just outside of Mobile I used to drive past called Perfect Alternative Baptist Church." I always wondered, alternative to what? Couple more. "Funniest church name I've ever seen is in my town. It is called Faith Free Lutheran Church." Punctuation is the key here. Faith, period, Free Lutheran Church. Last one. "When I worked for field education at Briarcrest College in Saskatchewan, Canada, we sent out a number of ministry teams to the surrounding towns and churches. One of those towns was Eyebrow, Saskatchewan. The church? Eyebrow Free Methodist Church." Church names are diverse, but they are important. Bowder writes in one of the books that I give you in the bibliography on the back, Bowder writes that denominational names, though they are going out of style, they really are a very important part of noting something about a church or a people. He says that the labels are kind of shorthand. They stand for a set of ideas. When people say, "I am a Lutheran,"
or I am a Presbyterian, they are not just identifying themselves with an organization or social group. They are identifying themselves with a combination of convictions. Each of the major denominational labels stands for a set of ideas. At one time, Christians thought these ideas were so important that they deserved labels. They used labels to distinguish one set of convictions from another. They wear their labels as a badge to identify their distinctive beliefs. Our church has a unique name. At some point in our study of What's a Baptist, we'll talk a little bit more about it. But normally, when an itinerant guy like the Fraser team comes and visits with us, or if we have a missionary who's new to our ministry, or sometimes when someone is passing through and they're a believing family, they'll ask me, is there a second Baptist church? A second Calvary Baptist church? They want to know about that name because it's actually a quite unusual combination, First and Calvary. So somebody might put on the website, well, hey, our church is the First Calvary Baptist Church. Is there a Second Calvary Baptist Church? I'm curious to know from you this morning who are here, how many of you have only known, as long as you can remember, you have only known a Baptist tradition. My hand is up. How many of that is true of you? That's interesting. Less than I thought. About half of you. So it's important then that I think we consider together what it means a Baptist, not only for those who have never had, who have not always had a Baptist tradition, but I think it's really important for all of us to understand, because I said to start the hour, I think there's a great deal of confusion about that. My children through the years have readily said this to me. Have any of your kids, when you're driving by a church building, saw the building, read the name, and then said to you something like this, Dad, Mom, what do they believe that we don't believe? Or what is different about them? Anybody had that experience in your head? It's happened to me on a number of occasions. So one of the tools that people have used to answer the question, what's a Baptist, is an acrostic. How many of you have seen an acrostic, something like that? How many of you have seen it? It takes the word Baptist and attaches something to it. And so the phrase is biblical authority. Autonomy of the local church. B, priesthood of the believer. T, two ordinances. I, individual soul liberty. S, saved and baptized church membership. T, two offices. And then many of them add a second S, separation of church and state. Now, I don't want to denigrate this acrostic too severely, because I do think it serves some purpose. I think there is some measure of helpfulness to it. However, it really isn't entirely accurate. Because, for example, let me talk about two. The first one, the B. We'll get to this in our next lesson. The B about biblical authority is not a distinction to Baptists. There are many, many churches, Baptist in their name, who embrace biblical authority. Not distinct to Baptists by any stretch of the imagination. Beyond that, the idea of this being a distinctive falls short, because it's not so much that Baptists have a biblical authority, but more than that, they look to the New Testament for the structuring of their church. And so when you look on the back of your handout, what you see is that the next lesson has to do with the biblical authority of the New Testament. So when you see the acrostic, it isn't really sufficient to describe what Baptists believe. Go down to one of the T's that says two offices. The T there really is, in our understanding, for pastors and deacons. Yet, it misses a really important Bible term, the term elder, which is not included in that. And where does that fit in? When historically, Baptist churches have recognized elders. So the acrostic, while helpful, should not be considered by us as sufficient or completely inclusive. though you might find it somewhat helpful. On the back of your sheet is the outline of where we're going. Maybe you have it there and can look over it with me. Can I borrow yours just one quick second? Thank you. The lessons mean that we'll cover them in this particular order, but not necessarily one a week. Some of them will take more than a week to cover. This morning, we're going to cover some introduction and history. The next lesson is about the authority of the New Testament. Three, what we call believer baptism. Four, a pure church membership. Five, individual Christian responsibility. Six, congregational government. Seven, separation of church and state. Number eight, organization, council, and other important matters. And number nine, answers to questions which you might have. And I hope you will have many. At the end of each hour, I'll give you some opportunity to ask them, but I may not answer your question in that particular hour. I may put that to the end and lump them together and answer the questions all at that one time. I do think it's really important for us to know what a Baptist is. I am a Baptist. I wear that label. I embrace that label. It's one of the few labels that I actually am willing to embrace. Mostly because I don't like if you put a label on me that I don't know what your definition of the label is. However, I'm not afraid, I'm not hesitant to wear the label Baptist. So the other day I was introducing myself to an individual. He asked me what I did for a living, and I said to him, I'm the pastor of a Baptist church. Or I will often say to people, I'm a Baptist pastor. I want people to know not just simply I'm a pastor, because I don't know what their background is. I don't know who they are. I want them to know something about me. I want them to know that I think a certain way, and I think like a Baptist thinks. And I think that's really important for you too. You're a member of a Baptist church. Okay, well, what does that mean? Why is it important that we have that label in our name, or that you wear that label as a badge? So let's do some work this morning on history. Where did we come from? That's a really interesting question. If you're a Baptist historian, where did we come from? You see, we have a problem. We can't do what the Lutherans do. They can identify a founder. And they look back to Martin Luther in the 15th century. And they identify in him one whom an original group of people followed. And they now are in succession of that. And so you can go back hundreds and hundreds of years during that time of the Reformation in Germany, and you can find Lutheran churches, and now there is a succession of them, so that our state of Minnesota is dominated, right, by Lutheran churches. By the way, like me, you probably have a number of opportunities to converse with people who are Lutherans in our community. Like the video a couple of weeks ago, you remember, of the older couple, and she said to him, I told him I cannot be involved in any romantic relationship with someone who is not a Christian, and clearly you're not a Christian, you remember that? And then it went to him and he said, and I thought I was a Christian? No doubt you've engaged many religious people like that here in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota has one of the highest per capita participation in organized religion in the United States. So you are likely to find someone who says, I am a, and then they might say, I'm a Lutheran. A really, really good way for you to engage a Lutheran is to ask the question, do you know what Luther believed? You say, well, I'm not sure I know what Luther believed. Yes, you do. Luther believed Romans, as in the book of Romans. Salvation by grace alone, through faith alone. We are justified by faith. As he came across reading the book of Romans, what the Bible says in chapter 4 about Abraham, that Abraham was justified not by the works of the law, but by faith. It was that idea that prompted Luther to study more and more and more, and it is that what brought Luther, a Roman Catholic priest, to conversion. And he was saved. A really good thing for you to do is to talk with your Lutheran friend, your new Lutheran neighbor, and say, do you know what Luther believed? They will probably say no, because they probably don't. In fact, they may have little idea of the difference between Martin Luther and Martin Luther King. You might use it as a gospel tool. Where do we come from? We can't do what the Mennonites do. The Mennonites look back to a man named Menno Simons, who was an Anabaptist, who developed his particular ideas about Christianity. And now Mennonites can look back to him. We can't do what the Methodists do. Methodists look back to a founder too. Does anyone know who the founder of that particular denominational organization is? Anybody know? John Wesley, that's right. And so John Wesley had a method for developing disciples, hence the term Methodists. But we Baptists don't have a person like that. We can't identify an individual and say, well, that is our founder. And that, of course, has led to a great deal of confusion and actually a significant amount of debate. So in answering the question, where do we come from? Here are some ideas. There are some who embrace something called succession. Would you take your Bible, and I've given you a text to consider, and that is in the book of John. Would you go to John chapter 1, and I'd like you to see what some people think about succession and where Baptist churches come from. That's what we're trying to answer the question. Where do we come from? How did we get started? What are our origins? That's an important question because that should tell us foundational ideas about what we believe, right? If we know where we started and what was it that prompted our start, that should give us some very clear understanding of at least the major core ideas that Baptists embrace from the time of their beginning. Make sense to you? So here is what some people think. John chapter 1, verse number 28. These things were done in Bethabara, beyond the Jordan, where John was, next word, baptizing. And that John, we know him to be who? John the what? John the Baptist. And there are a significant group of people who think that there is a succession from John the Baptist to the modern day. And they look at this in a chain. So some of them see what is called a chain of ordination. So in just a few weeks, in early June, our church will gather together to examine Nate Eldridge for the purpose of setting him apart for the ministry of the gospel. And that process is called ordination. There's an examination by a local church. The local church says, we've seen his life. We understand his doctrine. We believe the calling of God is on him for gospel ministry. It's a process that most pastors go through. For me, it happened almost 6 years ago now. Some believe that the succession is a chain of ordination. One Baptist pastor to the next Baptist pastor to the next Baptist pastor to the next Baptist pastor, thinking that you can go all the way back to the original Baptist pastor because the Bible says that's what he is, right? John the Baptist. You go all the way back to the original Baptist pastor in John chapter 1, this guy named John. Some see a chain of ordination. Some see a succession in what is a chain of baptism. And that chain of baptism only exists by those who were properly baptized. And individuals, Baptists who hold to this idea, are called landmark Baptists. How many of you are familiar with the phrase landmark Baptists? All right, just a few of you are familiar with that phrase. Not a whole lot of that here in Minnesota. As you move east and south, you will find a number of individuals who identify themselves as landmark Baptists. In fact, you might go to a church and you might see the Landmark Baptist Church of Timbuktu, whatever the state is. So what is a landmark Baptist? For a landmark Baptist, there is a test to determine whether or not a church is a true church. And that test is a church where only true baptism takes place, which raises a very natural question. What is the question? What? What is true baptism? Well, they have qualifiers for what true baptism is. A proper baptism, according to a landmark Baptist, is a baptism that includes the proper mode, the proper meaning, the proper subject, and the proper administrator. Without all four of those, the baptism cannot be true, and without true baptisms, you cannot have a true church. So what are those four proper criteria? A proper mode. The proper mode, a landmark Baptist would say, is complete immersion. Meaning. What's the proper meaning that a landmark Baptist would say? The meaning is it is symbolism. And the symbolism is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. There has to be a proper mode, proper meaning. There has to be a proper subject. The subject has to be a professing believer. Someone who can express their commitment to Jesus Christ and their belief in who He is and what He's claimed. And then the fourth criteria is a proper administrator. Someone who has received baptism under the authority of a true church. A landmark Baptist has proper mode, meaning, subject, and administrator. And let me ask you a question. Does our church meet the criteria for a landmark Baptist according to those four? Not a trick question. No. We embrace the first three. We embrace the proper mode, immersion. We embrace the meaning, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. We embrace the proper subject. You must be able to declare, I am a follower of Jesus Christ. I am a believer. But we do not embrace the fourth one, of a proper administrator. Let me give you an example. Let's say, which this isn't true of me, but let's say that I was baptized in a Bible church or a non-denominational church or the person who baptized me was, as in one case in this room, somebody's father who was not an ordained pastor. Now the administrator is not proper according to a landmark Baptist. Therefore, if you're going to become a member of a landmark Baptist church, you will need to be baptized again by a proper administrator. That really creates a number of problems. I'm not going to take a huge amount of time to go into that, but it creates a huge amount of problems as far as fellowship with other churches, identification as to whether or not another church is a true church. Is it a trustworthy church? Creates a great deal of issues. The succession that landmark Baptists see is, here's one church. It is comprised of believers who have received proper baptism. They all look to the succession previous to them. There was a church there who baptized according to proper baptism. That church looks to the next one, which looks to the next one, which looks to the next one, which takes us all the way back to John the Baptist. Does that make sense to you? I'm trying to answer the question for you, where do we come from? There are some who say that we come from a succession of Baptist churches who have practiced proper baptism, and you can trace that all the way back in their minds to the first century. There's a little booklet that actually promotes this. Maybe you've seen it. Has anyone seen the small red booklet called The Trail of Blood? Anybody ever seen that? A few of you have. In fact, I was given this at my ordination council. Because at my ordination council, one of the things that was declared to me, there were two. I'm happy to share them with you. One of the things that was declared to me about that I needed to improve on and get a better grasp in my ordination council was an understanding of Baptist history. The church which ordained me believed in the concepts of the Trail of Blood, that there is a succession of Baptist churches from the present day, which would have been 1988 at that time, all the way back to the first century, as evidenced in the booklet, The Trail of Blood. And so I was handed that. The second area had to do with my understanding of modern translations. And you all should be pretty well aware of what my thinking is on modern translations. So where do we come from? Some say there is a chain of succession that has to do with the proper mode of baptism. Let me give you a third succession. This one has to do with a change of church succession, so that there are local churches that are bearing the true marks of the church. And one church can look to its mother church, which can look to another mother church, which can look to another mother church, taking them all the way back to the first century. The fourth one is a chain of principles evident in individuals or churches who hold to Baptist ideas. That's the idea of succession. Where do we come from? Some people think that Baptist churches exist because they succeeded one after another from the first century. Let me give you a second potential answer to the question, where do we come from? And that is that Baptists are related to a group called the Anabaptists. How many of you have heard the term Anabaptist before? Okay, a little more of you. The Anabaptists were a group of believers, many of them, not all of them, but a group of believers who initiated at the time of the Reformation. Anabaptists by nationality were German, Dutch, Swiss. Some of them were good. Some of them were very, very bad. Anabaptist means to baptize again. So you have these church people who received baptism again as adults after leaving the established church, the church at Rome, which would have been in place in Germany or Dutch or Switzerland at the time. And so some people think, well, because that group baptized again, that it must be true that we are from them, because we baptize some people again who were baptized as infants, for example. But the historical evidence really does not connect Baptist churches with Anabaptists. The evidence is really quite overwhelming that even though there might be a similarity in name or a similarity in some idea, that really there is not a physical connection between the two. So, where do we come from? Doesn't appear that succession is the answer. It doesn't appear that we are related to the Anabaptists of German, Dutch, and Swiss heritage. So, what can we say? I think the best that we can say is this. That Baptists are part of the English separatist movement from the Church in England during the time of the English Reformation. See if I can help you understand that a little bit. The Reformation occurs roughly from 1450 to 1600. It is a critical, crucial time in the life of the church, meaning the universal church. It is of huge importance and cannot be overstated in any way, shape, or form. The importance of the Reformation. Roughly 1450 to 1600, it begins on the European continent, primarily with an original reformer, Martin Luther, and then it expands to some others like Zwingli or Calvin and still more. When it reaches England, not the European continent, it has crossed the channel and it has come to England. There are there those who are separating from the Church of England. You know one of their names. In fact, you probably know it very, very well. He is the author of Pilgrim's Progress. His name is John Bunyan. John Bunyan separates from the Church of England. John Bunyan is probably one of the most well-known Baptists in our lineage. And those who separated from the Church of England did so over a number of matters, including believer baptism alone as valid baptism according to the Bible. So where did the term Baptist come from? Well, let me tell you where it doesn't come from. It doesn't come from John chapter 1. The term is a derogatory term. It was given by other religious groups to the group of people who separated out and received baptism again as an indication of their conversion to faith in Jesus Christ. They were called the Baptists, not as a term of endearment, but as a term of degradation. So by 1610, the Reformation is the time of it, 1450 to 1600. It really has the Reformation itself come to a conclusion. The reform that initially started in the Roman Catholic Church has birthed this new protesters of what is going on in the church at Rome, protesters to what is going on at the church in England, Protestants. By 1610, there is ample evidence, documentary evidence, of a succession of Baptist churches. By 1641, at the absolute latest, the doctrines and the practices of Baptists are really now the same, no matter where you go in England or on the continent, that is the European continent. What Baptist churches believe and what they practice is essentially the same in all essential features, even as they are today in Baptist churches. So where do we connect the faith and life of Baptists? Where do we see it originating? We connect it really to other reform groups of the 16th century. Reform groups like Lutherans or Calvinists or Zwinglians. And there are a couple of points of agreement between Baptists and those other groups at the time in the 16th century, the time of the Reformation. One of the points of agreement, very strong protest against what was called popery in all of its expressions. Popery, meaning the office of the Pope and everything that flows out of his office. All of the ideas related to Roman Catholicism, that practiced again at every Mass, the sacrifice again to God of Christ, that saw as the Pope one who would speak as the Vicar of Christ. All the expressions of popery, these groups stood in opposition to it. And there was a second point of agreement between them, and that was this: a genuine zeal to recover the spiritual life of the Church. The issue that led Luther really to question what was going on in his own church, of which he was an ordained priest, was the issue of indulgences. What's an indulgence? The Pope at the time was a man by the name of Leo X. He was building Rome to be an edifice actually to himself. He was not a godly man. He was not a trained theologian in any way, shape, or form. The history is absolutely fascinating how he comes to the office of Pope at the time that Luther is on the scene. And he practiced indulgences, which means various priests would go village to village. They would inquire of people, and they would pay a certain amount in order to have a sin forgiven or a coming one forgiven. Here's one I'm thinking about. Let me drop a few coins in, and that one will be forgiven too. Luther saw this as an offense to the people. He saw this as abusive of the people, and he was right. And it prompted his study of the Scriptures. He saw in that a waning spiritual life in the church. Where was the Bible? Where was prayer? Where was communication among the disciples? That is, the people, the adherents to the religion. Where were they discussing Jesus Christ? It was void. It was vacant. And so the second of the elements which brings these groups together is the desire to recover the spiritual life of the church. I think the best way to understand the origins of the Baptist tradition is to see them in what is called the Free Church Movement of England in the 16th century. Those who were leaving the Church of England over the issues which I just said. The result was this: there are local congregations who desire to follow the Holy Spirit and to understand Jesus Christ, the head of their church. And so they raise the question at this time: how do we do that? How do we follow Christ? And their answer was, we should study the Bible together. We should pray together. We should discuss what we're reading in the Bible together. We should come to joint decisions as a local congregation. Everything that we do, right? And so they developed a principle of consensus regarding doctrine and morals and ethics and church organization and purpose and education. So the best we can say as to the origin of what is called the Baptist Church really goes back to the mid-16th century in England and those who withdrew themselves from the Church of England. Some of them were Puritans. Some of them were Anabaptists. Some of them were separatists. Not all of them were. That's the best that we can do. But there is a caution about this. To say that they were separating from the church does not mean that they acted in a spirit of individualism. Instead, they insisted on a very disciplined church. But the discipline for that church came from within, not from without. It wasn't a structure from without that disciplined the church. It was from within. It was the whole gathering of the people who made up that local congregation who disciplined themselves and said, as with a group, we agree, this is what we believe about doctrine. This is what we believe about morals. This is what we believe about ethics. This is what we believe about organization. This is how we will come to a consensus on our decision making. You see, prior to that time, when a local church assembled, religion did not teach that that was a true church. But Baptists believe this, that the true church is visible. When we gather today for worship, we believe the church is visible here. We believe that the true church is expressed in the gathering and the fellowshipping of believers who are bound together by a covenant with God and with each other and who are committed to a faithful witness. That is an original idea from those Baptist churches in the mid-16th century. Prior to that time, the true church did not exist in the gathering of the disciples. The true church existed in some kind of hierarchy in Rome or in London. It is a critical, critical idea that the church contributed. And that, of course, was costly. When you read the history, it led to incredible persecution. There are untold numbers of Baptists who gave their lives so that you and I could practice how we practice today. You're familiar with Bunyan. Bunyan's persecution did not cost him his life, that is, physically. He was not executed, but it cost him 12 years in the Bedford jail. And the Bedford jail was no happy, comfortable place to be. When you read the sorrow of Bunyan's life as his wife would come to bring him meals, because the Bedford jail didn't provide much, you're struck by the fact that what these individuals believed, they believed to their core. And in many cases, it cost them dearly. By the way, why was Bunyan jailed? Two things. Bunyan was jailed because he was an unlicensed preacher. The Church of England had not given him the official credentials to preach, and he was preaching anyway. The second reason that Bunyan was jailed is because he did not attend regularly the services of the Church of England. This is our history. There's so much more. I have volumes and volumes on my shelves of Baptist history. We've covered it in 35 minutes or so. But hopefully that gives you a little idea of where we've come from. I can take two or three questions here before we finish things up this morning. What do you have? Oh, that's not good. That either means you're really, really, really... Yes. Yep. Uh-huh. Yes.
What is the connected from Galatians and
good question.
To the Roman Catholic Church?
Good question.
Breaking from the Roman Catholic.
Good question. So where do you get, how does Christianity unfold? Okay. Let me answer that question. Are you going to be okay? Curtis, well, should be okay if I don't answer this question immediately here. It would take me a little longer than the minute that I have to answer that particular question. Okay. I will give you this little bit of a teaser. You have first century, which is what you've talked about in Acts and the pastoral epistles. You go up until about the 4th century BC, and then you have a declaration by one of the emperors that Christianity is the official religion of the empire. That begins in the 4th century. that really then becomes the practice. It is the official now. So you have something called the Great Roman Empire. And you see, not only is the leader of that a political leader, but he is a religious leader. I'm actually answering your question now. He is a religious leader. And a political leader. And that happens for centuries. Centuries, all the way through the Middle Ages, until you get to about 1450. And you have this uprising of religious people who desire to see the church return to what they see in the New Testament. So you have this massive length of time of about 1,000 years or more, where the church is what we would recognize as the church at Rome. And so you can take this progression of popes or leaders and take them all the way back. Does that help? One more, real quick. Yes. It wasn't necessarily what they were going to use. So you mean like where they were gathering?
Well, not necessarily where they were gathering, but just the idea is like, was it more of because they were breaking the law?
So yes, so part of that is because they were breaking the law. Because the Church of England, the head of the Church of England is the king. And when you don't go to his church, you break his law. And in breaking his law, you offend him highly. Hence, you end up in the Bedford jail. Does that answer your question? All right. So send me questions. We'll go more next week. Next week, we'll start with some of the distinctives that are here. I hope it whets your appetite a little bit more for what about this. Thanks, everyone.